I'm Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Campaign number 5, Gentleman John Burgoyne's Great Gamble, Ticonderoga to Saratoga. It's the summer of 1776, and General Howe, the commanding British general of the British Army in the American colonies, came up with a strategy to end the war quickly. General Howe would move up from Manhattan up the Hudson River going north, while Guy Carleton, the governor of Quebec Province, and General John Burgoyne, another British general, would move south from Quebec, coming down Lake Champlain, and capture Fort Ticonderoga being held by the American forces. They would meet up with General Howe coming north up the Hudson. They would then go east to Boston, squeeze the American patriots, and end the war. British General Howe's Hudson River Lake Champlain strategy, given the sizable landmass of the 13 colonies, was straightforward, easy to understand, and possibly doable, despite significant geographic obstacles in the region. The problem, however, was not so much reckoning with the logistical challenges of moving large forces across waterways and over swampy, hilly terrain, but with the generals themselves. More or less on his own, General Howe decided he would end the war more quickly and with greater personal glory by chasing after George Washington's Continentals and grinding them into the ground as they fled for their lives across New Jersey and over the Delaware River back to Pennsylvania. General Clinton objected, so General Howe sent him off to establish a winter naval base in Rhode Island. British Governor General Guy Carleton, for his part, was the most cautious of them all, not wanting to proceed south until he had a powerful enough naval fleet to clear Lake Champlain of any possible resistance. By the time he finally moved his flotilla onto the lake in early October 1776, the number of days for sustained campaigning were almost gone, with colder autumn weather coming into play and frigid winter conditions lurking in the background. In sum, the British generals, pulling this way and that, had nothing to show for their campaign activities in 1776, despite so much effort on the part of the British Crown to get them thousands of troops and enough military supplies to crush the ever-growing rebellion before it was too late. As for General John Burgoyne, he was now having doubts about General Guy Carleton's cautionary leadership from Quebec, and also thinking about greater martial glory for himself. Placed in charge of land forces that followed along after Carleton's fleet began to sail towards Lake Champlain, he could not believe that the governor stopped his southward movement at Crown Point on the lake, some 12 miles north of Fort Ticonderoga, held by the American patriots. General Carleton, after considering such basics as maintaining a secure supply line back to Canada over the winter, as well as having been impressed by the fighting prowess of the patriot fleet defending Lake Champlain, decided to pull back all his land and naval forces to regroup for a timely invasion in 1777. All along the way, British General John Burgoyne studied the terrain and gained an impression of how easy movement by water through the Champlain region would be with a large, well-equipped army and proper naval support, especially with what he surmised would be insignificant rebel resistance. Burgoyne just couldn't bring himself to believe that the Americans had any sustained fighting capacity, despite the incredibly brave stand by General Benedict Arnold's much weaker American fleet at Valcour Island on Lake Champlain on October 11, 1776, and General Arnold's death-defying stand at Split Rock on the lake 2 days later. General Guy Carleton did understand the American abilities, and he had backed off for the winter season. Unlike General Burgoyne, Carleton recognized the rebels' capacity to put up a good fight, even with inferior numbers and equipment. Just as importantly, Governor Carleton wanted to defeat his adversaries, but leave them with enough self-respect to be able to rejoin the British Empire with some dignity left. General John Burgoyne, on the other hand, was an inveterate gambler who too often wagered his bets without taking his opponents very seriously. Burgoyne's mistake in 1776 was his reckless pride in assuming that the likes of General Benedict Arnold and other American rebel defenders on Lake Champlain would cut, run, and hide in the face of superior, in numbers and weaponry, British forces. After all, as Burgoyne reported in July to British General Clinton, the American retreat from Canada was most unsoldierlike and disgraceful, and in November Burgoyne crowed about the complete victory obtained over the enemy's fleet on Lake Champlain. In hindsight, Burgoyne was wrong on both counts. In his second letter to British General Clinton, General Burgoyne wrote about the passing of his wife, whose various ailments had cut her life short back in June 1776. His wife's death became a reason to return to England that winter to attend to a few duties yet remaining to the memory of Lady Charlotte. Furthermore, Burgoyne claimed to have a constitution unfitted to the severity of cold Canadian winter weather. He needed to seclude himself from this country for the next 6 months. Since his motives for returning home were purely magnanimous, all interest, ambition, and the animation of life did not motivate his return home. He was flattering himself, of course, as his dominant reason was to secure a more important military assignment. Burgoyne added that serving in a secondary station in a secondary army is at no time agreeable for a man like himself, one so full of military talent. Making a quick passage home to London, England, General Burgoyne was soon meeting with none other than King George III, who in turn commended him to Lord George Germain, Secretary for American Affairs and Chief Strategic Planner for ending the American Rebellion. Burgoyne tried to be coy, pretending that he was not complaining about Governor General Carleton's supposed dilatoriness when he was invariably damning the governor with faint praise. Naturally, the King and Germain, who despised Governor General Carleton for other reasons, wondered whether Burgoyne could put together an operational plan that would assure success during the upcoming campaign season. With outward humility, he assured them that he was just the person to do so. General Burgoyne's thoughts for conducting the war from the side of Canada bore the date February 28, 1777. As in 1776, the objective of this plan was to move a substantial army at a rapid pace from Montreal, Canada, to Albany, New York, which was a little over 200 miles. There, this force would effect a junction with British General William Howe before charging through New England. Burgoyne recommended that Governor General Carleton, whom he implied was a little decrepit for the task and obviously slow-moving, should receive orders to stay in Canada with 3,000 troops to protect Quebec province from a possible enemy incursion. What Burgoyne was really saying was that this year, 1777, he intended to be the star of the military show, never again just a secondary general off campaigning in some obscure theater of war. Burgoyne went on to insist that he needed at least 11,000 troops and up to 1,000 Canadian Indians, along with 2,000 Canadian auxiliaries, some with enough nautical skills to move this huge army by water southward to the lower end of Lake Champlain in New York. To facilitate his own rapid movement, Burgoyne recommended a diversionary force of 1,500 or more regulars, loyalists, German Hessians, and hundreds of Indians drawn from the Six Nations, including Mohawks and Senecas, to sweep southeastward from Lake Ontario, Canada. There, they were to take control of the western end of the Mohawk Valley, then sweep eastward toward Albany, New York, some 100 miles away. Presence of this detachment would force the American resistors to defend on two fronts, thus dividing what strength, if any, they might have left to slow down the British advance. Lieutenant Colonel Barry St. Ledger, an experienced veteran of warfare in the Canadian region going back to the Seven Years' War, would take charge of this diversionary column with a brevet rank of Brigadier General. General Burgoyne would obtain what he most craved, overall command of the whole operation. Lord Germain, back in England, however, did not guarantee him the 11,000 troops he had requested, especially with 3,000 assigned to stay back in Canada. As finally constituted, this grand northern British army consisted of 3,576 British, 2,919 German Hessian, and 511 artillerists, all designated as fit for duty, for a total of 7,006 British combat soldiers. General Burgoyne had hoped to enlist about 1,000 Indians, but only about half that number, Wyandots, Ottawas, Abnakis, and Canadian Mohawks, agreed with some reluctance to sign up for scouting duty. About 800 Canadians came along as militia, day laborers, and boat crewmen, not the 2,000 General Burgoyne expected. The total force, including consorts, wives, and children, was an estimated 10,000 persons, about two-thirds of the number that Burgoyne had indicated, but not insisted, that he needed to assure complete success in reaching Albany, New York, in a timely fashion. Among the strengths of this expeditionary army were the talented general officers assisting, but not upstaging Burgoyne. At the age of 46, British Major General William Phillips was among the most gifted artillery officers in the British Army. In direct charge of the German Hessian soldiers, many of them Brunswickers, was Major General Baron Friedrich Adolf von Reichstadt, age 39, a skillful leader who politely put up with General Burgoyne's pomposity. Also highly competent was Brigadier General Simon Fraser, age 48, who repeatedly showed no fear in leading the way in combat situations against the American Patriot resistors, for which he ultimately paid the price with his life. As for Burgoyne, he bubbled over with confidence. Even before he had gained official approval to lead the expedition, he had the temerity to place a wager with a friend, the price of a pony, that he would be back in England, crowned with great laurels of victory before the end of 1777. One London observer dubbed him General Swagger. Gentleman John Burgoyne was acting as if he were about to embark on a summer camping adventure. Obviously, he felt compelled to bring along all the comforts of home, which amounted to several wagon loads of essentials, apparently including several uniform changes for himself and the family silver tea service. For his additional well-being and personal pleasure, Burgoyne arranged to secure a mistress by awarding her obliging husband some advance in rank as a commissary officer. On June 14, 1777, General Burgoyne, having gathered all participants and equipment, including 130 artillery pieces, ordered the expedition to move out of St. John's, Canada, on the Richelieu River. According to his thoughts for conducting the war, the Army's first objective was to capture Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain. Within a week and a half, Fraser's advance corps had crossed Lake Champlain and reached Crown Point on Lake Champlain, a distance of some 200 miles, actually about halfway to Albany, New York. The rest of the Army arrived there by June 30th. Amid the ruins of a once mighty British fortress, everyone rested for a couple days before moving out to attack the American Patriots at Fort Ticonderoga, some 12 miles by water to the south on the lake. Burgoyne, using his gift for condescendingly florid prose, issued a public proclamation on June 24th, warning all rebel bumpkins in his army's path to give up their frenzy of hostility or suffer the direst of consequences. As he explicated, "The present unnatural rebellion rested on the most completest system of tyranny that God in his displeasure suffered for a time to be exercised over a forward and stubborn generation, to continue to resist his mighty army, best appreciated as true messengers of justice and of wrath, was to guarantee devastation, famine, and every concomitant horror for every colonist who did not submit the unstoppable military machine advancing under his command. The taking of Fort Ticonderoga seemed to verify Burgoyne's locked-in perception that breaking the Patriot will to fight would be easy. The extensive grounds at the fort, including outlying redoubts, lacked the troop strength at this point in the war to be properly defended by the Americans. The commander in charge, Major General Arthur St. Clair, a Pennsylvanian not known for his military prowess, had only 2,200 defenders, about one-fourth of General Burgoyne's British numbers. They were short of weapons and ammunition, as well as basic supplies, including food. Ripe to be overrun, and overrun they were. By July 4th, Burgoyne had his force ready to strike from various angles. The German Hessians were sweeping down on the east side of Lake Champlain to cut off any rebel retreat through Vermont territory to the east. Moving south on the extreme right was General Phillips with an artillery column. He decided that cannons could be placed near the top of Sugarloaf Hill, today's Mount Defiance, which rose 750 feet in elevation and literally overlooked the fortress from the southeast. General Phillips supposedly quipped, "Where a goat can go, a man can go, and where a man can go, he can drag a gun." On the afternoon of July 5th, 1777, Fort Ticonderoga's defenders observed the artillery battery that could easily fire cannon shots down on them. Obviously overwhelmed on all sides and now outflanked by the British, American General St. Clair wisely issued orders to retreat, which took place under cover of early morning darkness on July 6, 1777. Hardly firing a shot, General Burgoyne had the rebels on the run, easy pickings indeed, and run the rebels did. Some escaped east into Vermont territory, where the next morning they engaged in a bloody battle at Hubbardton against General Fraser's advancing British corps. Those who got away eventually made it to Fort Edward, located about 40 miles away along the east side of the Hudson River in New York. General St. Clair, meanwhile, led a fleeting contingent of about 500 men in boats, first to the lower end of the lake at Skeensboro, which is today's Whitehall, New York, where they burned everything in sight. Then they proceeded overland for 24 miles to Fort Edward, where they regathered with the Vermont group and local militia that the overall Northern Department commander, Philip Schuyler, was beginning to pull together as an American fighting force to resist at all costs what so far had been the rapid advance of General Burgoyne's army. As for Gentleman John Burgoyne, he was ecstatic. In a feigned attempt at personal humility, he wrote to Lord Germain in London from Skeensboro, "The instruments I have to employ are so good that my merit will be smaller." As he had convinced himself over and over again, the American rebels lacked the physical, mental, and military capacity to fight effectively against the likes of General Elbow Room. As he considered matters, it had taken his army little more than 3 weeks to move more than 60% of his way down his target. From Skeensboro, the distance left to reach Albany, New York, was only about 70 miles. What Burgoyne could not imagine was that his rapid southward movement was all but over. If someone had told him that he would never reach Albany, he would have scoffed at them. Nor would he believe that over 2 months later, his army would still have more than 30 miles of backwoods terrain to cover before reaching Albany. Once they had subjugated Fort Ticonderoga, about everything that could go wrong for Burgoyne and his minions did. It was almost as if the wilderness started to devour the British Hessian army alive, as it reckoned with traversing the landscape below Lake Champlain, which was much more of a debilitating enemy than a cooperating friend. Back in 1776, Burgoyne had traveled no further south than Crown Point on the lake with perhaps a quick scout of the Ticonderoga area. He had no knowledge of the terrain beyond this point, or of the possible difficulties of moving overland through jagged hills, across streams, and through swamps to reach the Hudson River. In his Thoughts for Conducting the War, Burgoyne took it for granted that no significant geographic obstacles could possibly cause serious problems for his mission. Making this assumption was a major blunder on Burgoyne's part. The logistical challenge was how to move his soldiers and weaponry southward to Fort Edward. Burgoyne had two choices. He used both. In a retrograde movement back to Fort Ticonderoga, Burgoyne issued orders to have a portion of his artillery pieces and heavy baggage shipped up Lake George, which basically paralleled Lake Champlain to the west. After reaching Fort George, at the lower end of Lake George, everything had to be unloaded, placed on gun carriages, carts, and wagons, then hauled by pack animals overland 16 miles to reach Fort Edward. This operation proved to be a logistical nightmare, and the weaponry did not reach General Burgoyne until around September 10, 1777. As for Burgoyne, he and the bulk of his troops sailed back to Skenesboro to begin an overland trek to Fort Edward that would take them 3 weeks, a distance of only about 24 miles. This little-used route was not easy traveling under any circumstances, and it was now to be made even more treacherous by the harassing tactics of bands of American rebels, including militia companies from New York and Massachusetts. Acting as well-organized partisans, they cut down trees and rolled large boulders onto the crude pathway. Since the weather was rainy that month, they opened spillways from swamps to produce flooding conditions, and they took pot shots at the enemy troops when possible. The Americans engaged in a delaying firefight at Fort Anne, about halfway to Fort Edward, all of which slowed Burgoyne's army to move forward a little more than only a mile a day. Burgoyne remained resilient through it all, as if losing so much time was not a problem, but he should have been worried. As already indicated, American patriots in the region were rallying to the standard of Northern Department Commander Philip Schuyler, who was operating out of Fort Edward in early July. Thanks to George Washington, Schuyler received significant leadership support from General Benedict Arnold, whom the Commander-in-Chief considered his best fighting general. Arnold, who played such a key role in Governor General Carleton's decision to retreat from Lake Champlain back in 1776, rendezvoused with Schuyler on July 21st. Together they devised a fallback strategy that had Schuyler organizing additional troops to the south of Fort Edward, while Arnold would direct a small detachment in picket duty designed to gauge the enemy movements while continuing with delaying tactics. During Arnold's assignment, the murder of Jane McCrae was observed, an incident fraught with implications. On July 27th, Arnold sent out a picket company to determine the whereabouts of Burgoyne's force. While watching at Fort Edward, they were suddenly overrun by a large party of Indians, along with an advance column of British regular soldiers. They retreated, but not fast enough to avoid having six of their number killed and scalped. As they gained some distance, they observed some Wyandotte Indians drag two women out of a house, one of whom was beautiful young Jane McCrae. Supposedly, she was waiting there to meet her betrothed, a loyalist officer named David Jones. The Wyandotte Indians argued over which one of them she belonged to and then settled the matter, as General Arnold reported, when they shot, scalped, stripped, butchered her in the most shocking manner. Burgoyne insisted on punishing the responsible Wyandotte Indian, but the Indian chiefs demurred. In council, they told Burgoyne to back off or they would start returning back to Canada. He mollified them with alcohol, but only temporarily. Over the next several days, his Indian allies started drifting away, bored with the slow pace of the British march and the lack of promised opportunities to plunder the countryside. Before August was over, Burgoyne had less than 100 Indian scouts still available to stalk American rebel pickets and provide intelligence about growing rebel resistance. His Canadian auxiliaries were also heading back north by the hundreds. To keep supply lines back to Canada open, he had assigned close to 1,000 soldiers to garrison duty at Fort Ticonderoga and Fort George. Still, Burgoyne insisted that the Americans cannot finally impede me, and he expected that successful progress would allow his shrinking army to reach Almaty by August 23, 1777, at the latest. Exuding complete confidence, according to Baroness von Ruysdael, who was traveling with her husband and their children, General Burgoyne was having a jolly time, carousing at night while amusing himself in the company of the wife of a commissary who was his mistress and liked him, loved champagne. Indulgence in champagne no doubt helped Burgoyne to discount the reality of the campaign that was collapsing around him. During August, he suffered 3 major blows, one of which was definite news that General Howe would, as in 1776, not be playing his intended part in the British Hudson Champlain strategy. During the end of July, General Howe had ordered 15,000 troops onto 2 transports in New York Harbor. They would sail out to sea, then move up through Chesapeake Bay, where they would land. Then they would march toward Philadelphia with the idea of catching American General Washington's Continentals in a major set-piece battle that would destroy the main rebel army and, in theory, end the war. Ever confident, Burgoyne acted as if he really didn't mind, since he was sure that he could make it to Albany all on his army's own. Then they would rest over the winter while preparing for a major assault on New England in 1778. Clearly, Burgoyne believed, or pretended to believe, that under his brilliant leadership, his army could do it all. Reading from General John Burgoyne's Great Gamble, Ticonderoga to Saratoga, in Campaign No. 5, in the 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, will be continued. This is American History. This is Wallace Klinghans, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.